The Tony Greg Show.
Welcome to the Tony Greg Show on Crick Info Talk.
News this week.
Well, as predicted last week, India and Sri Lanka are at the time of recording about to start the final of the Asia Cup. I don't think there is much between these two sides, and it's therefore likely that the team that puts it together best on the day will win the match. This Asia Cup has been relatively uneventful in so much as there haven't really been any major upsets. Sure, it's always nice to see the home team in the finals, but I suspect that most Pakistanis will be happy that they at least had some cricket in their own country. It must be ever so frustrating for players and administrators to put together any meaningful plan if most of the cricket fraternity feel it's too risky to tour. Jeff Lawson, the Pakistan coach, allowed his frustrations to get to him when he had the most amazing go at the local press. Journalists stormed out of Lawson's press conference as tempers frayed after the Pakistanis lost by 64 runs to Sri Lanka, which pushed the host to the brink of elimination. A visibly upset Lawson attended in place of captain Shoaib Malik and immediately set down the ground rules. A couple of rules before we start, he said. Don't make statements. Ask questions. If someone asks a question twice, I won't answer it. Make questions sensible, otherwise I won't answer it. Not the most diplomatic way to conduct a press conference. I haven't seen Jeff Lawson to ask him his side of the story, but it's never a good idea to be rude to the press. They have a habit of getting square, and they did. Lawson apologized to the media a day after the heated press conference, but the journalists who attended the conference categorically refused to accept the apology. They demanded an apology from Lawson in person and not through a press release. They wore black armbands and protested for 15 minutes outside the National Stadium in the break between the innings of the Sri Lanka-Bangladesh match. It took a handwritten letter from Lawson apologizing unconditionally to appease the journalists. While they are satisfied for the time being, they are still expecting an apology from Lawson in person. The press will almost certainly now push for Lawson's position to come under review after the tournament. The Pakistan Cricket Board, on the other hand, their chairman, Nazim Afraz, had said that both the captain, Shoaib Malik, and the coach, Jeff Lawson, will retain their jobs despite the team failing to reach the finals of the Asia Cup. In fact, they've both got two-year contracts. On the cricket field, the batting has been dominated by Raina, Sangakkara, Yunus Khan, Sehwag, Dhoni, Jayasurya, Gambhir, Shoaib Malik, Kapil Khedira and Misbah Al-Haq. They all averaged over 50. Now, that's not bad, but the fact that they all also managed strike rates of over 90 is quite incredible. So some really good batting on what were obviously very good pitches. The leading wicket takers were the Sri Lankan spin twins Mendes and Muralidharan, who also had very economical figures, with Sohail Tanvir and Iftikhar Anjum just behind them. The test series between England and South Africa is looming and should be very interesting. England, despite their 2-0 victory over New Zealand in the test series, still have some chinks in their armour, and the South Africans definitely boast a strong pace attack. The first test is at Lord's, where England has struggled over the years, and the South Africans will be aware of that. Mind you, the second is at Leeds, and there are those of us who think that this is where England received their best support, and the conditions also suit bowlers used to English conditions. The Yorkshiremen over the years have always been very supportive of the English side, and vocally so as well. England will be hoping for a good series from Kevin Peterson, because they know if he has a good series, they can play around him and therefore succeed. Peterson, having been born in South Africa, also having been on the receiving end of plenty of criticism for leaving South Africa, will be very determined to show what he can do. He, like the rest of the England batsmen, will have to be on their toes, because Dale Steyn, Mackay Ntini, Andre Nell, Mornay Morkel and Jacques Callis are all capable of aggressive spells. The England players have braced themselves for a tougher encounter than they experienced against New Zealand, but I don't think there is much between these two sides. If Ryan Sidebottom, James Anderson and Stuart Broad continue to swing the ball, they will make up for their lack of serious pace and see to it that England are always in the hunt. As expected, Australia are on their way to comprehensively beating the West Indies in the one-day internationals in the Caribbean, although the fourth match in St. Kitts could have gone either way. I'm predicting a whitewash, and so we'll be back to the drawing board once again for the West Indies. They certainly are going through a tough time. There are undercurrents at the moment in West Indian cricket that seem to be hindering progress. What they are, I have absolutely no idea, but I see a few quotes have been attributed to Julian Hunt, the president of the West Indies Cricket Board recently, in which he gave us a bit of a clue that all is not well. He told the West Indian players they must start performing at a level that matches their pay packets. It was a stunning outburst ahead of the fourth one day against Australia. With the windy still staring down the barrel of a 5-0 series clean sweep in St Kitts, Hunt has told his team in no uncertain terms that they either start winning or run the risk of disappearing into insignificance in world cricket. As expected, the West Indies captain Chris Gayle replied in kind and is on course for a showdown with the West Indies Cricket Board after taking aim at both selectors and officials. Gayle doesn't take many backward steps on and off the cricket field, and he was quick to voice his displeasure over the selectors' decision to experiment with young players this series against the might of the world's number one Australia, while also warning the West Indian Cricket Board of a possible player exodus if they were not careful. There is absolutely no doubt that another battle is looming between the West Indies board and the players.
What's eating Tony Greig?
After many behind-closed-doors meetings in an effort to resolve the Zimbabwe crisis in Dubai, the Zimbabwe delegation was persuaded to recommend to its board that the Zimbabwe team should pull out of the ICC World 2020. The delegation has undertaken to report back on the decision of its board to the ICC within 1 month, and I think it's probably a formality. The ICC has been discussing Zimbabwe's futures at a board meeting in Dubai after England and South Africa broke off cricket relations with Zimbabwe last week. The sports governing body has decided Zimbabwe will not, for now, be suspended from international cricket. But that may change pending a fresh investigation of Zimbabwe cricket by independent ICC committee, which will include Dr. Julian Hunt from the West Indies, Arjuna Ranatunga from Sri Lanka, and one other still to be announced. I'm certainly not into kicking a dog when it's down, but there is nothing the ICC can do for Zimbabwe while Robert Mugabe continues to terrorize the country. Common sense suggests that their membership of the ICC should be suspended until things change. The question as to why this hasn't happened is simple. India wants Zimbabwe's vote to get their way at ICC meetings. Simple as that. It seems to me that what is happening in Dubai was little more than a sham, a highly artificial game of cricket politics that ended with England getting what they wanted, the World 2020 Championships, India maintaining its leverage to twist the arms of the other members at future meetings, Pakistan getting the oval forfeit reversed, and Zimbabwe hanging on to their membership and therefore the dollars. Cricket just has to find a way to govern itself without allowing self-interest to dictate policy. I'm not blaming India because they no doubt see this as payback time for all those years England and Australia did exactly what India are doing now. Perhaps we have to put up with the current farce for a while to get everyone to appreciate what cricket really needs. Smart, impartial government. The only way to do this is to run cricket the same way a public company is run. We need the best qualified board of directors to whom the various committees and executives will report. Don't hold your breath, though. Turkeys don't vote for Christmas. There was one really good speech made at the ICC conference that came from James Sutherland, Cricket Australia's CEO. He said that a new format for Test cricket and the incredibly popular 2020 format will ensure them both strong futures, but that world cricket should not lose sight of the fact that its prosperity has been built on the 50-over one-day game. Cricket, he said, is in great shape and was probably the world's second biggest sport, but its success depends on three formats. In this context, Sutherland thinks that we should never lose sight of the fact that international cricket is the foundation on which cricket has been built. Sutherland is of the view that it is not only the foundation of the game, but for all members, possibly the exception of India, cricket could not survive without it. He thinks international cricket is cricket's lifeblood and that if we compromise it, we do so at our peril. He is absolutely adamant that 2020 must be designed, structured and promoted so as to complement, not compromise, international cricket. Sutherland also called on administrators to respect the role of players and listen to their views. Some pretty sensible stuff there.
My favourite cricketer.
With the South African tour of England underway, I thought I'd share a few of my thoughts on Graham Smith. At the age of 22, Smith became South Africa's youngest ever captain and had few leadership credentials and barely a handful of internationals under his belt. But for a nation eager for a fresh start after the disasters of the Huntsie-Cronje affair, Smith was clearly made of the right stuff. Smith is tall, an attacking left-hand opening batsman, whom in 2003, when the South Africans toured England, made double centuries in consecutive test matches. Now, that doesn't often happen. 277 at Edgbaston and 259 at Lord's. The 277 is the highest individual innings ever made for South Africa, and the 259 is the highest score ever made at Lord's by a foreign player. The success of his opening partnership with Herschel Gibbs is well known. They are South Africa's most prolific opening partnership ever. Smith has the distinction of having been part of all four of South Africa's opening partnerships of over 300 runs. In three of them, he was partnered by Gibbs, and in 2008, Smith added 415 for the first wicket with Neil McKenzie against Bangladesh, a world record opening partnership. Like so many good left-handers, Smith is very strong through the leg side. He does dish it out a bit to the opposition, but what I like about him is he's also prepared to take it back. He has proved to be a solid captain who leads from the front. He also has a very credible test batting average of 48, and in one day, the Nationals average is 41 at a strike rate of 81, also very acceptable. Who will ever forget his role in the record-breaking contest between Australia and South Africa when Australia, batting first, made the then world record score in one day internationals of 434 for 4. Smith then smashed 90 from 55 and added 187 for the second wicket with Herschel Gibbs in just 20.1 overs. South Africa eventually won the match with 5 deliveries left to go. Graham Smith, a very, very good cricketer.
One question only.
Right, the question today comes from Prashant Venkatesh. He wants to know what I think is the best way for a middle-order batsman to bat with tail-enders. Do I feel that the conventional way of facing 5 out of 6 balls is the way to go, or do I think the way adopted by Sachin Tendulkar with Ishan Sharma in the Sydney Test against Australia earlier this year is a better way, where Sachin gave him 4 or 5 out of 6 balls in an over to face? Does that method instill confidence? Do you think such a strategy can consistently work? Well, Prashant, a lot depends on the state of the game, the circumstances and the ability of the lesser player. Recently, with the exception of Glenn McGrath, the Australians had faith in all the rest of their lower order. Adam Gilchrist, for example, was happy to take the runs as they came when batting with the Australian tail. I've always been of the view that bowlers should try to get both batsmen out rather than resort to that negative tactic of putting all the fieldsmen back for the good players, then save singles when the tail ender is on strike. It's better, in my view, to have the sweepers back, but give the batsman a gap or two, inviting risk and therefore the opportunity to get him out. This, in turn, keeps the game moving rather than the tactic of playing 4 balls and allowing the tail ender to handle 2. That's boring, let's face it, unless it's a really tight finish. Please don't forget to email your queries to tony@trickinfo.com. Don't forget to mention your name and the place where you're from. I'll pick the best question and answer it in next week's show. Thanks for your company. This is Tony for Cricketfo Talk.
The Tony Greig Show on Crick Info Talk.